Today at Reader's Corner, science writer Rebecca Skloot, author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks.
For some reason, Henrietta's cells just never died, and they are still alive today, growing in laboratories all around the world. And they really were one of the most important things that happened to medicine in the last 100 years. All I knew was there are these incredible cells that came from this woman no one knew anything about. I had no idea what her family had been through. We have an enormous biotech industry now that's based on buying and selling cells and tissues and gene patenting and all that. And it really all traces back to her cells. They were the first human biological materials ever bought and sold.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In 1951, an African-American woman named Henrietta Lacks was diagnosed with terminal cervical cancer. She was treated at Johns Hopkins University, where a doctor took a sample of cells from her cervix without telling her and soon discovered that the cells could not only be kept alive, but would also grow indefinitely. Author Rebecca Skloot first heard about Henrietta Lacks' amazing story in a community college biology class. Her years of investigation into the life and legacy of Lacks, whose story had largely been lost to history, led to her fascinating debut book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Boise State has selected The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks as its 2011-12 campus read. Incoming first-year students receive the book in their orientation this summer and read it in preparation for discussion during the upcoming fall semester. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Rebecca Skloot. Her book introduces us to Lacks and her surviving family and friends and the science and economics behind one of the most important medical discoveries of the last 100 years. The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks was named the best book of 2010 by Amazon.com and received the 2010 Wellcome Trust Book Prize. It is now being made into an HBO movie produced by Oprah Winfrey and Alan Ball. Ms. Skloot joined us by phone for the interview. Rebecca Skloot, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on that distinction from Amazon.com as Best Book of 2010. Oprah's going to do the HBO movie. This is all very exciting, and perhaps we should start at the very beginning. Who was Henrietta Lacks, and why is she so important to medical history and discovery?
So Henrietta was a poor black tobacco farmer who grew up in Southern Virginia in the 30s and 40s. And when she was 30 years old, she got cervical cancer, and she went to Johns Hopkins Hospital to get treated, and without her knowledge, before treating her cancer, her doctor just took a little piece of her tumor and put it in a dish and sent that down the hall to George Guy, who was the head of tissue culture research at Hopkins at the time. And scientists around the world had been trying to grow human cells outside the body for decades, and it had never worked. Sometimes they would grow for a few days, but they would always eventually die. And George Guy was one of those scientists, and for some reason, though to this day no one can really explain why, Henrietta's cells just never died, so he put them in a culture dish, and they are still alive today, growing in laboratories all around the world. And they really were one of the most important things that happened to medicine in probably the last 100 years. They were used to help develop the polio vaccine. They went up in the first space missions to see what would happen to human cells in zero gravity. The first genes ever mapped were hers. The first cells ever cloned were hers. And the list of advances just goes on and on. And she never had any, she didn't have any idea the cells grew, and her family didn't either until many years later.
Isn't there some theory, I think you mentioned in your book, that there is some evidence perhaps that a disease that she had might have had something to do with why these cells took off?
So her cervical cancer was caused by HPV, the virus that
right. You
know we now know causes cervical cancer. They didn't
right.
know that at the time. And in fact, one of the advances that came from her cells was the vaccine we now have that can now prevent cervical cancer from HPV. So we do know that she had HPV and had multiple copies of it. She also had syphilis, which can weaken your immune system and cause cancer to grow more rapidly. So those things definitely played a role. But there was something else that researchers haven't pinpointed. A lot of people had HPV and syphilis in the 50s, and their cells didn't just grow. So it was those two things combined with something in her makeup that made her cells take off the way they did. And her cancer grew with the same sort of intensity. So these cells would double their numbers every 24 hours in the lab, and they really grew with a sort of veracity that nobody had ever seen before. And they did the same thing in her body. So she had a nickel-sized tumor when she went to the doctor, and within about 6 months, that tumor had spread to almost every organ in her body, and she died not long after her 31st birthday. So there was something about her cancer combined with the HPV and the syphilis that was really powerful.
And something that to this day we really don't know.
Yeah, it's still a bit of a mystery.
You spent 10 years researching this book, and I'm really delighted that you're willing to talk about that, because we have a lot of students here at this university, and I'm sure many other places, who think writing can be an overnight success. So your diligence and your stick-to-itiveness proves that it takes lots of time to pull something like this off. And in the course of that 10 years, there must have been moments, especially given the difficulty of working with the family at the outset anyway. We're going to talk about Deborah, Henrietta's daughter, and how you became such good friends and how you eventually gained the trust of the family. But what was the problem in the earlier years? Why was there such difficulty getting inside the family and gain their confidence so you could write this book?
Yeah, well, you know, I had learned about the cells when I was in a basic biology class. It was actually a freshman biology class at a community college. You know, it was a big auditorium classroom, and my teacher, like most teachers, biology teachers, at some point said, you know, there are these incredible cells. They've been alive since the 50s. And he, for some reason, knew her name, which most people didn't. And he wrote Henrietta Lacks on the board and said she was a black woman. And that was it. And it just stuck with me. And I went up to my first class. I was like, well, you know, what else do we know about her? And who was this woman? And, you know, did she have kids? And what do they think about all this? Do they even know that her cells have done all this amazing stuff? And he was just like, sorry, we have no idea. And he said, you know, maybe go do a little research, write up a little paper. I'll give you some extra credit. You know, and that was in 1988. And so it just stuck with me. And then many years later, I wasn't planning to be a writer. I was going to be a veterinarian. And so I just went on. I got a science degree and eventually took a creative writing class as an elective in my junior year of college. And I just really, I started getting interested in writing. But I didn't start trying to write about the family until about 10 years after I learned about her. And when I called them, all I knew was there are these incredible cells that came from this woman no one knew anything about. I had no idea what her family had been through. And in fact, a lot of the book is about their story and the fact that after Henrietta died, you know, scientists came back to them 25 years later to do research on her kids without telling them, to learn more about the cells. There was a lot of trauma involved in this for her kids, and a lot of things that were kept from them. Their medical records were released to the press at one point. I mean, the list of things that had happened just went on and on, and I didn't know. And I just sort of showed up one day saying, hi, I'm going to write a book about your mother. And I didn't know where I fit in that chronology of all these people. So I was essentially just yet one in a long line of people who'd come to them wanting something having to do with these cells, particularly white people, and it hadn't worked out well for them ever. So they just refused to talk to me for at least a year, and I would call and try to win their trust. And so a lot of the process of working on the book did involve winning their trust, which, you know, really required understanding why they didn't trust me in the first place. And, you know, they had a lot of good reasons to not trust me.
Well, once you did gain the trust of some of the initial family members you dealt with, you put yourself in harm's way. There were a couple of instances in this book where you read of you're not really knowing whether somebody's going to pull a gun, haul off and hit you across the face, whatever they might do. I mean, some members of this family were in pretty difficult straits over the years, thrown in prison, acted violently, and in one particular setting, I think you were being set up to meet one of the sons, and it was a pretty scary situation to read that. I'm sure it must have been to be there.
Yeah, you know, and it was, yeah, that particular son, I mean, he had, all I knew about him the first time I met him was that he had murdered a man in broad daylight with a kitchen knife. And so, yeah, it was a pretty scary guy. I tried to sort of be smart and safe about it. And I would only talk to him outside. And, you know, but it didn't necessarily make the whole situation safer. You know, it's funny, by the time I actually met the family and started spending time with them, I really understood where their anger and fear was coming from. And I think I just sort of was like, I just have to do this to figure out what the story is. And I just sort of was going along, you know, I was sort of young and But it's funny because many years later when I finished the book, my dad read the first draft of the book, and I think he almost had a heart attack when he read some of the scenes. And he was like, I can't believe, I'm so glad you didn't tell me you were doing this, but I can't believe you did this. And like, you know, but I survived.
Now, the HeLa cells themselves help us understand more about how they have been used over the years. You mentioned how they were used in the treatment of cervical cancer, but way beyond that over the years, these cells have been used in laboratories across the world. And their numbers, I mean, I think I saw some incredible number of how much they would weigh today if they were all gathered together.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. So, yeah, in the 50s, once scientists realized how important these cells were, they just started mass producing them. They actually set up a factory where they grew them assembly line style to the tune of about 6 trillion cells a week. And so now, yeah, there was an estimate, one scientist estimated that if you could have gathered them all together and put them on a scale, that by now the amount that would have grown from that first sample would weigh more than 50 million metric tons, which is more than 150 Empire State Buildings. Yeah, and cells weigh almost nothing. So it's almost inconceivable how many cells could have grown from this one little tiny sample from her cervix. And the advances made using them are amazing. And one of the things I love about the book being used in these campus-wide READ programs, and I often go and talk at schools when that happens, is, you know, students will come to the book and be like, oh, God, it's a book about cells. Do we really have to read a book about cells? And
right.
You know, and then you just start reading it. It's like, oh, wait, no, this is a book about a family and what it means to lose a mother and these very personal things. And then what they often end up realizing is that they have personally benefited from her death. And it's incredible to hear the stories that students have. You know, they will come up to me and say things like, my mother got, you know, this certain cancer and is still alive today because she took a drug that was made using HeLa cells. And so I feel like I have my mother because Henrietta's children went through all of this difficult stuff when they lost theirs. And so they feel a real intense personal connection to the cells. And that exists for everybody. Like anyone who's gotten a vaccine, anyone who's, you know, the most common cancer drugs, vincristine, tamoxifen, you know, long list goes back to her cells, drugs for Parkinson's. And so it's really amazing to watch people have that realization that it's not just a story. It's not just, you know, this, it's definitely not fiction. And not only is it a real story, but it's actually one that they are somehow involved in personally. Which I think is a kind of an amazing thing. There aren't very many stories like that.
Well, Henrietta did eventually die of cervical cancer at a very young age, but reading about the way she was treated for it was just downright barbaric by today's standards. I mean, her body was turned black by the use of radiation over and over again. Obviously, they were using techniques then that you'd never use today, but what role did the fact that she was black play in this treatment?
Yeah, the race is a very complicated thing in, throughout the story, because she was treated at Johns Hopkins, which was one of the top cancer centers in the country, and those treatments that she was getting were very early cancer treatments, and that's what it was the top of the line treatment at the time. It was, you know, they were doing radiation, but at such higher doses than we do today, because they didn't know yet that they didn't have to use such high doses. And so the treatments themselves were did seem very barbaric, but they were also standard for everyone. But the reason that she was at Hopkins was because she was black. So this was during segregation. She couldn't go to most hospitals because they wouldn't see black patients. And at Hopkins, they saw black patients, but only in their public wards. These public wards, you know, we know now from looking back at segregation that when black patients were treated in segregated wards, that they were treated later in their disease process. They didn't get as good much pain management. They were often hospitalized much later. And all of that was true for her. She really was, and a lot of this is also still true today, but she was treated pretty late. She was in a lot of pain. And she actually, they weren't going to hospitalize her. She actually one day went in and just said, I'm not leaving. I'm too sick to go home. And that was when they finally hospitalized her, and that was pretty close to her death. And until then, she'd been making these long treks back and forth almost every day. So that was all very much related to her race. But the actual treatment that they gave her once they gave it to her was what they would have given a white woman. And, you know, and later, of course, race plays a role as well in her, with her children and their lack of access to education and how the researchers treated them. And so it's very tied up with race and also class, really.
You said something about the oral history, especially in the Jim Crow South, where they would tell stories about black people who were kidnapped by hospitals or for research. And your comment after that, at the end of that paragraph, I think, said something like, there are some disturbing truths behind these tales. These were called, they called them night doctors, these folks who supposedly would kidnap these folks. I wasn't clear whether this really happened, but then when I got to your last line, I gather you must think that there is some truth to what happened in those cases.
Yeah, there's a long history of mistrust between, I mean, minorities of all kinds, but black Americans especially, and the medical research world. And a lot of that does trace back to the slavery era when slaves were used in research without their consent often. And there was this legend of the night doctors, of doctors who would go, who would snatch black people off of the street and take them to the hospital and do research on them. It actually started then, and that was a way of controlling the slaves and keeping them from going out at night, because they would snatch them up and do research on them sometimes. And it did happen. There were cases, they called it birking, where people were snatched off the streets far after the slavery era, and they were used in research. There was a lot of body snatching of black bodies that were used in research. You know, and this also happened to white people, but it definitely happened more to black people. So there's a long history of African Americans being used in research without consent. The Tuskegee syphilis studies is one of the big examples, where men who were infected with syphilis were studied essentially to just watch how syphilis killed people, so they weren't offered treatment when it was available. So that all of these stories combined to and they're passed on through oral history and families, I mean, to this day, and they make it very hard for, you know, there are a lot of scientists who are trying to bridge the gap between medical research and African Americans, you know, get them involved in studies, because in the end, it is actually harmful for African Americans. They're, you know, not being as represented in drug studies. They're not getting the same access to care. So they're trying to bridge this gap, and it comes with a lot of really painful history that a lot of white, especially white America, doesn't know about. So they really think, they hear black people saying things like, you know, I'm not going to participate in that AIDS study because you're going to inject me with AIDS. And they just think, you know, right. Well, it's like a crazy conspiracy theory, but it's actually based in fact. It actually comes from a long history. So part of telling that side of the story was really, I hoped to get that history out there as part of this story.
You're listening to Rebecca Skloot. She is the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, which was just named by Amazon.com as the best book of 2010. Help us understand the difference between what happened to Henrietta in her day and what would have to happen today. Henrietta didn't even know they were taking her cells. There was no such thing as informed consent. Put Henrietta in the year 2011. She goes into the hospital for surgery and treatment. What's different today?
In some ways, nothing. But in other ways, there are some differences. You know, to this day, so much research depends on human samples taken from people for research. And if the samples are taken specifically for research, which is what was done with her children in the 70s, that does require informed consent. It violates federal law to go to someone and take a sample just for research without telling them. But if you're taking the sample for some other purpose, like a biopsy or, you know, a routine blood test or any number of things that happen when you go to a doctor, if you're taking them for that purpose and then they're saved after the fact and your identity is removed from them, then that doesn't require informed consent. Those go into tissue banks and they're used in research all the time. So at this point, I mean, most Americans have tissues sort of on file somewhere being used in research and they don't realize it. You know, any child born in after the 1960s, it became federal law to take blood samples from newborns to test them for genetic diseases, and those are often stored for research, and people don't realize it. So, in some ways, you know, not much has changed. People's tissues are used in research a lot without their knowledge. But what's changed is that you would never name something after someone anymore. So you would not call cells HeLa, which stands for HE for Henrietta and LA for Lacks. You would get some barcode number that isn't connected to the person's name. You know, but there's a lot of debate right now about sort of what do we do about that. Most research on human tissues doesn't require consent. There's commercialization of a lot of this research. there's no requirement to tell people, you know, hey, we may make money off of this, you're not going to, which was a big part of the problem with Story for the Family. So there's a lot of discussion actually today in Science Magazine. There's a big policy paper coming out where a lot of researchers from various institutions around the country are saying we need to reevaluate it, because the public is now very much aware of the fact that this is happening and we're not getting consent, and it's really, we owe it to them, you know, to ask their permission before we use their tissues in research. So I think we're at a time of change with all that.
So all of these HeLa cells, which all emanated from Henrietta Lacks, those are growing and they're being sold on the market by huge biotech firms. Who's making all that money? I assume not the Lacks family.
Right. Yeah, so HeLa cells were, you know, we have an enormous biotech industry now that's based on buying and selling cells and tissues and gene patenting and all that. And it really all traces back to her cells. They were the first human biological materials ever bought and sold. And, yeah, there are large businesses that have grown out of that. And you can go online today and buy a vial of her cells for about $200, or you can buy products made using her cells up to $10,000 a vial. And that money, right, it goes back, it's in the companies. The family has never seen any of that money. And, in fact, it's quite poor, and they can't even afford health insurance. And so they often say, you know, if our mother was so important to medicine, why can't we go to the doctor? And they've never really gotten an answer to that. There's a lot of the companies that are selling the cells saying, well, say, you know, well, how much of this, these products that we're selling are actually a direct result of HeLa cells? You know, if you'd taken her cells and put them on a table, they would have died. It required a lot of invention to keep them alive and then various things. So there's a lot of just, people don't really know how to think about the money even, because they don't know how to separate out how much of it is HeLa, how much of it is, but no one's really tried, because there's this concern that if you start talking about paying people for their cells, then people will start holding out, it'll interfere with research. And so there's a lot of debating going on about who should be profiting off of research materials like these.
Let's talk about the rest of the Henrietta Lacks family, especially Deborah. Deborah unfortunately died before she could see this book in print. You had become a friend of hers, as the book unveils. Deborah is the reason why you were able to get into so much of this information and deal with so much of the family. But I'd like to go back to the time of Henrietta's death, which had these violent and tragic consequences for her children, and which tell a whole other story about growing up, about parenting or lack thereof, about what can happen to kids who are mistreated, in this case violently, and then grow up to repeat the behavior, I guess you could say. Tell us what happens to these kids after Henrietta dies.
The story of her children, it's the story of what, you know, what happened to them when the world got Henrietta's cells, really. So it's this sort of amazing offshoot of what happens when you lose a mother, and especially when you're living in poverty. And women in general are such, they're often the source of stability and safety in a lot of homes like the Lacks family. So when Henrietta died, she had five kids, and one of them was epileptic, and she was institutionalized because no one could take care of her. And she died at 15 in this institution in a pretty disturbing situation. And the rest of the kids were, various cousins would come and trying to help take care of the kids, and they were physically abused, sexually abused. I mean, what they experienced after the loss of their mother was really tragic. And the son that we mentioned earlier, who had a very violent past and had murdered someone, I mean, he had experienced the worst abuse of any of the children. And he was also the youngest. She was pregnant with him when she found the tumor. So he never had a mother from basically day one. And so it is. It's a story about what happens when you lose a mother, and also the long-term effects of abuse.
Wasn't it her father's friend, girlfriend, or whatever, Ethel, that ends up taking care of these kids? And a word about her father, because he didn't strike me as a model of fatherhood, to say the least.
No, I often get emails from readers just really wanting to vent about how frustrated they were with him. Because, you know, yeah, and his story is tough. You know, they were so poor, and they were from this tiny place where, you know, he had a fourth grade education, and, you know, his wife died, and then he basically just spent all his time working, trying to support the kids. And, you know, he really thought he was doing right by them, but he didn't step in and stop any of the abuse, and just, you know, was pretty sort of in some ways apathetic to a lot of what was going on. And so there's definitely some readers get frustrated by that. But, you know, he really didn't know any better. I mean, his kids often said this, you know, and often people will say, I mean, he brought home a lot of sexually transmitted diseases when Henrietta was alive. she died of a sexually transmitted disease. And so often readers say, well, you know, didn't he kill her? It's like, you know, you sort of can't go there. It was with time. Like, he didn't even know what syphilis was. And, you know, he really, in a sense, was doing what he had the capacity to do, but unfortunately wasn't much. But that part of the story is very difficult.
You said at one point that writing this book challenged everything you thought you knew about faith, science, journalism, and race. Let's just take science for a moment. Here's Deborah, who is tracked down by these researchers. I think his name was McCusick and his graduate assistant, Hu. And they come in and start taking her cells or something. And she thinks she's being tested for cancer. I mean, it was really sad to see how upset and distraught this woman was for a significant period of time.
Yeah, when in fact, a lot of her adult life.
Yeah, a lot of her. And all they were doing is using her the way they used her mother. I mean, there are moments of your book when I have to say it does challenge your faith in science, in doctors, in researchers, in medical ethics, most importantly.
Absolutely. And one of the things that happens in the story is, you know, there are a lot of lows like that that really do challenge your sort of faith in science. But then there are also some high points. You know, a scientist who many, many years later, towards the end of the book, comes forward and says, I really want to help this family. I want to teach them what these cells are. I want to bring them into my lab and, you know, answer any of their questions. And, you know, so in a lot of ways, the story is about all of this extremes of science and the ways that it can be, you know, amazing and wonderful and the ways that it can be very damaging. When the scientists came to her family in the 70s, they had no idea. They didn't, and I often hear this today, they really couldn't imagine how little the family understood about science. There's such scientific illiteracy in this country still, especially among, you know, poor populations. And, you know, when Deborah's father, Henry's husband, got the phone call saying that these researchers wanted to come test the family, the way he understood that, he had no idea Henry's cells were alive. The way he understood the call was, we've got your wife, she's alive in a laboratory. We've been doing research on her for the last 25 years, and now we have to test your kids to see if they have cancer. He didn't even know what a cell was. He actually thought they had her in a prison cell. He just had no concept of what a cell was. And so the family really did think that they were being tested. Her kids were around the same age that Henrietta was when she had died, so it seemed to make sense. And the scientists just never stopped to explain anything to them. They didn't try. I mean, I talked to them about it, and they said, no, of course we didn't try to get informed consent. We just wanted some cells. That moment is an illustration of how important it is for scientists to be able to communicate science to the general public and the repercussions that can come when they don't. So the family, it really sort of destroyed Deborah in a lot of ways for many years. And she was very concerned about what these cells were. You know, if they were shooting these things up to the moon and injecting them with chemicals, did that somehow hurt her mother in the afterlife? She was worried she needed to be protecting her mother from some of this research, that she might feel some of the pain of it. But she also very much hoped that she could learn something from the cells. She would ask scientists, you know, can you look in these cells and tell me what my mother's favorite color was and whether she breastfed me? Because she was really desperate to know who her mother was. So there was this mixture of all these pretty powerful emotions tied up with it.
Well, Rebecca, we've run out of time, and I regret that. The good news is there's a book out there that's about to come out in paperback in May, and when it does, you can get the hard copy now, but of course you could get the paperback as well. And I know our listeners are going to want to fill in the details, the many details we couldn't really get to here. I do want to point out, and thank you for doing this, because I thought this was a very generous and kind gesture on your part. When you look at the back jacket of this hardcover book that I have in front of me, it says the author has established a scholarship fund for the descendants of Henrietta Lacks. Donations can be sent to HenriettaLacksFoundation.org. So I guess the point is that our listeners can go on to HenriettaLacksFoundation.org and learn more about how they might want to contribute to this foundation.
Thank you. Yeah, and the some of the book's proceeds go in there. And so far, right now, it's paying tuition and books for 5 of her grandkids and great-grandkids to go to college, and it's helped with some medical expenses. So it's been pretty amazing to experience reader response to it.
Oh, wow, that's even better news. We're delighted to hear that. Thank you so much for joining us today on Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Rebecca Skloot. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.